It is Friday, October 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming your way, the United States and Russia discuss their differences on Syria. The balance of power in the world of politics in the United States seemingly shifting a bit over the past week toward Hillary Clinton. This could be one reason.
You know, I would imagine I've thought more about what happened than all of you put together. I've lost more sleep than all of you put together.
VOA national correspondent Jim Malone pays us a visit. We'll talk about that. And a new film explores the story of what happened to one of America's top news anchors. It's all ahead. We begin today with attempts to quell the violence that has overtaken Syria. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian, Saudi, and Turkish counterparts met in Vienna today, seeking to revive whatever effort might be available to end Syria's civil war. Kerry began a day-long series of meetings at a hotel in the Austrian capital with the foreign ministers of Saudi Arabia and Turkey, both of whom share the U.S. view that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad must go if the conflict is to be resolved. Kerry then met separately with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, whose country is Assad's prime backer. The four ministers then held a group encounter. Speaking after talks with Jordanian as foreign minister, who was also in Vienna but not present at the group meetings, Lavrov called on other countries to step up efforts to bring peace to Syria. And perhaps more importantly, he announced that Russia and Jordan had agreed to coordinate their military activities in Syria. Lavrov said the two countries would set up a center in the Jordanian capital to coordinate their air campaigns over Syria. No details were given about that. We welcome to International Edition Sim Tak, a military analyst for Stratfor Global Intelligence. They're a geopolitical intelligence and advisory firm based in Austin, Texas. Sim, thanks for joining us. Does this Jordanian element, is that a surprise to you?
It's not an entire surprise. It comes somewhat, in the middle of a very, very delicate time when Baghdad is trying to make its mind up whether they stick with the U.S. support or go with the Russian offer to extend their air campaign into Iraq. We've seen some hints at efforts to coordinate between the U.S. and Russia in terms of deconflicting their air campaign. It's quite notable, though, that Russia is doing this directly with Jordan rather than through the U.S., which sits kind of on top of the entire multinational effort in the air campaign over Syria.
What's Russia up to here in Syria?
The reason that Russia is going into Syria is not simply about propping up Assad, about offering him military aid. I think the much higher level objective for Russia there is to secure its position in the Middle East as a player. And they're very much doing so by forcing everyone to negotiate with Russia on the future of Syria. And then second to that, Russia is also in a much broader discussion with the U.S. or trying to pull the U.S. into that discussion anyway, where it also could include the situation in Ukraine and the general balance between the West and Russia. The big reason that Russia is behaving this way is that they are actually seeing a negative time ahead. They are facing massive demographic constraints. They are facing ethnic crises inside the country. Their economy isn't doing very well, obviously, because of low oil prices, because of sanctions. Russia is kind of preparing itself for a dark time, if that makes sense.
Sim Tak is a military analyst for Stratfor Global Intelligence. He joins us from Austin, Texas. Sim, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
One of many interesting stories taking place today, and joining us, we are very happy to have our social media editor, Andrew Palczewski, with us. What is trending as far as social media is concerned?
One of the big trending topics today is hashtag Hurricane Patricia. Now, this is the hurricane that's swirling in the Pacific off the coast of Mexico, poised to strike on the west coast of Mexico. So
seen the maps of this thing?
Well, that's what a lot of people
Dark
are sharing.
Yeah.
A lot of people are sharing that on social media, the maps. There's live feeds to Puerto Vallarta, which is a big tourist beach town, and it looks already just dark and very dangerous and scary. So a lot of people tweeting about that. Hashtag pray for Mexico is already trending as well. It hasn't even made landfall yet, and people are already hoping that it fizzles out or misses, or some kind of act of God to keep this hurricane away from Mexico and all these people that it could impact. Interestingly, we were talking about just before I went on, some of the embassies are reaching out to people using social media to reach out and try to protect their folks. The UK embassy has tweeted out and said, if you're in Mexico, you're on vacation, get away from the coast, try to get to safety. So it's just kind of a wait and see. Everybody's anticipating. People are trying to send in pictures from there and trying to evacuate as best they can and waiting for it to make landfall.
Maximum sustained winds of this thing near 325 kilometers per hour, 200 miles per hour. Rainfall of 15 to 30 centimeters, up to 50 centimeters in some isolated areas. This thing's dangerous.
It absolutely is. And I wouldn't be surprised to see, as it makes landfall, some amazing video coming out on social media and the aftermath as well. And then, unfortunately, we're going to see some of the rescue and recovery on social media. And then also some of the donations I'm sure we'll be seeing in the next week to where people can send their support, their money, and supplies.
We hope something happens. What else is going to?
Hopefully. Adele, of course, the famed British singer, multi-Grammy Award winner. She had an album 19 when she wrote when she was 19. She had the album 21. She's been off for 4 years. She's 27 now, but she's announced her new album, 25, that she wrote when she was 25. She said it's not a breakup album, it's a makeup album. And she released the first song from this album called Hello, and it has set social media on fire. People are saying, oh, it's going to be an emotional winter. The album comes out November 20th. The single Hello is out today.
You haven't heard it yet, huh?
I've heard it several times. I've heard, and I'm sure I'm going to be hearing it a lot over the weekend. People are going to be playing it. It's not really a good song to play, you know, out at a bar or a pub or something like that. It's a very sad kind of song. But people saying, you know, they're listening to it, and it's, you know, already they're getting upset and emotional. And the one thing that people are noting in the music video, Adele, in towards the beginning of the music video, uses a flip phone. So they're saying Adele's bringing the flip phone back. Done with smartphones. Adele's bringing the flip phone with her into this new record.
She's just getting old. Andrew, thanks a lot. Andrew Pelcheski, the International Edition social media editor. Hopefully we talk again next week.
Absolutely.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Since 2004, NASA's Cassini spacecraft has been sending back spectacular images and providing scientists with valuable data about Saturn and its many moons. Cassini has returned to Saturn's ice-covered and sixth-largest moon, Enceladus. The spacecraft has passed by the moon a number of times since 2005. During a recent flyby, the spacecraft sent back high-resolution images of the moon's northern region. The scientists were quite surprised to see what Cassini had sent back. Based on images taken by the 1970s Voyager mission, they thought that the moon's northern region would be heavily cratered. Instead, the new images show that Enceladus's northern landscape is crisscrossed by a spidery web of what looks like delicately thin cracks that cut across its surface. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Let's move on over to American politics, if we will. And who better to talk about that than VOA's national correspondent, Jim Malone, who joins us in studio. Jim, there's a lot of things to talk about. First of all, let's talk about what's happened to Hillary Clinton. She seems to have a little more smile on her face these days than she was a few weeks ago.
I think she has lots of reasons to have a wider smile at this point, Ira. Let's look back over the last week and a half. She had a strong performance in the first Democratic debate. We had the decision by Vice President Joe Biden not to run in 2016. That will probably help her. And then we had her sitting for 11 hours or so before the Congressional Committee on Benghazi. And although there was a lot of back and forth and at times some tense moments, she comported herself quite well, and at the end of the day, the feeling among most of the analysts and pundits was that she had helped her cause and reducing the danger that Benghazi posed to her as a political issue moving into the 2016 campaign. So she's got a lot to be happy about over the past 10 days.
Well, let's give a little contrast here. As a couple of years ago, one of the many Benghazi hearings that's taking place down the street from us here at the Capitol on Capitol Hill in Washington, here is how she reacted to a question just kind of trying to dig out why she didn't do more, why investigations weren't happening. Here's what she sounded like.
The fact is, we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator.
And now a similar question and her kind of thinking about how she felt at the time and how she answered this week.
You know, I've thought more about what happened than all of you put together. I've lost more sleep than all of you put together. I have been racking my brain about what more could have been done or should have been done.
Major difference, Jim, as far as her tone is concerned. She prepared for this thing, didn't she?
Yes, and I think that that earlier response you cited from 2013 in front of the Senate, I think she realized that getting hot under the collar, it could be taken the wrong way. It could be seen as kind of a dismissive statement. Maybe she didn't care as much about the people who died as she should have. And certainly she had a much different tone and approach for this latest House hearing. She did not get rattled during the hours of and times intense questioning. Some of the folks who looked more rattled were the questioners on the Republican side who were, kind of badgering her for her answers about what they had said previously about the Benghazi situation. The thing about the Benghazi hearing, it seems so far, is not a lot new came out of this latest go-around, even after all the hours of testimony. And even the chairman, Trey Gowdy, the Republican chairman, asked late last night at the end of the hearings, what did you learn new? I mean, he even had a little trouble kind of coming up with the new revelations that were produced.
And there has been much as far as criticism is concerned about how much money is being spent and the number of hearings on Benghazi are taking place.
Right. To be fair, though, this was not a great moment, not a highlight for Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State. She realizes that. She was trying to focus on the four people who died, including Ambassador Chris Stevens. But this is not something she'll be touting in her election campaign, how she handled Benghazi. But did the Republicans' investigations of it, was that commensurate with the actual problems that were highlighted? Voters will have to make up their minds on that. But right now, she appears to have weathered whatever political ramifications from the Benghazi probe that may have been there.
So what do you think helps her the most? I, from what you just said, can anticipate your answer here. Is it her testimony this week? Was it her performance on the first Democratic contender debate? Or was it the decision by the vice president not to run?
You know, I really think that all three of those things coming together within a very short period has now crystallized the idea that she is just as strong a front runner as people thought several months ago before some of these problems began to dog her campaign. The one thing we'll say, though, there is a continuing investigation about her email practices by the FBI. That's looking at whether any classified information was vulnerable during her setup with this private email account. That's still out there, but she has done so much in the last 10 days to reassert her status as the clear Democratic front runner with now no real other alternative who might come into the race. It's going to be her and Bernie Sanders from Vermont, who has a strong following. But can he do enough to overtake her? It's not looking a likely possibility right now.
Let's turn to the Republican side. A whole different picture here with some very, very interesting personalities running.
Absolutely. And we continue to focus on outside personalities, Donald Trump, but even Dr. Ben Carson, who's had a little surge in Iowa in two recent polls. Iowa is important. It's the first state that votes. It often can be a springboard, especially in the Republican Party, for conservatives who want to contend. And it looks like Ben Carson is benefiting from a greater appeal among women voters than Donald Trump has, at least in the Republican caucuses there, and probably from his appeal to evangelical Christian voters. They're an important bloc, especially in the state of Iowa. They tend to vote in a unified way for one candidate. There's a lot of churches, especially in western Iowa, that send people out on caucus night. And so right now, he's had a bit of a surge, and we have to say that in Donald Trump's point of view, he still continues to lead in national polls, but this surge by Ben Carson in Iowa could mean something down the road.
Overall, many people who are listening to this in countries other than the United States are still saying, wait a minute, this election isn't for a long time. Why is so much being paid attention to? What's going on?
Well, because the cycle does start basically 2 years before. It involves fundraising. It involves getting your message out. And the fact is that the candidates running are spending and paying a lot of attention to the polls right now. That dictates their strategies in the various states. And you have someone like was thought to be a strong front runner, the former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. It's just been some news in the last few hours here that he may be cutting back on his campaign staff in Florida, a signal that he has not been able to gain traction, as many people thought he might, with Republican voters. They still seem to be drawn to these outside contenders, these non-politicians like Trump and Carson.
VOA's national correspondent, Jim Malone. Jim, as always, thanks for stopping by.
Always a pleasure.
This is VOA.
I'm Neil Arcega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Thank you so much for joining us here on International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington, D.C. We shift our attention now to the world of entertainment. Interesting motion picture that David Byrd's going to tell you about momentarily. It deals with things close to our heart here, and that is journalism, and especially but one of the major top U.S. news anchor people and who went through quite a bit. And the movie talks about that. Oscar winners Robert Redford and Cate Blanchett explore the controversial events surrounding the downfall of former CBS News anchor Dan Rather. It's a new film that opens around the U.S. today from Sony Pictures Classics called Truth. International Edition's David Byrd had this look at the film, which also stars Dennis Quaid and Stacey Keach.
The year is 2004, and George W. Bush is running for re-election. Then CBS News anchor Dan Rather and producer Mary Mapes broadcast what became a highly controversial report that said the former president had used his father's political influence to escape service in Vietnam. The movie is based on Mapes' autobiographical book, Truth and Duty, The Press, The President, and The Privilege of Power. The controversy over the so-called Killian documents, documents which criticized Mr. Bush's service in the Texas Air National Guard instead of going to Vietnam, is the center of the film. It was learned later that CBS had not authenticated the documents, which were supposedly from Bush's commanding officer, the late Lieutenant Colonel Jerry B. Killian. The network eventually repudiated the documents and its reporting and issued a public apology. Both Mapes and Rather lost their jobs, along with several executives at the network. At the Los Angeles premiere of the film, Cate Blanchett, who plays Mary Mapes in the movie, said that Truth presents the facts without spin or revision.
And I think the film is like a glass of water. It presents the events as they happened and then throws it back to the audience to say, well, how do you feel about corporate media ownership and its proximity to politics? And I think it transcends cultures. Yes, it's very particularly about American politics and American media ownership, but that those questions are relevant whether you live in Europe or Australasia or the States.
Robert Redford plays Dan Rather in the film. Redford did not attend the L.A. premiere, but Cate Blanchett says that working with him was something she had wanted to do for a long time.
To work opposite him, I mean, he's so disarmingly frank and present and engaged, and he asks really dangerous questions, I think, both politically, culturally, socially, but as an actor, he puts people at ease but also keeps them on their toes, and that's a very rare sort of quality to get to the chance to act opposite, so I relished every second.
The film marks the directorial debut for James Vanderbilt, better known for his writing and producing of The Amazing Spider-Man, Zodiac, and The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Vanderbilt says he revels in the kind of story that gives viewers an insider's take on events.
And I love movies where you can kind of go behind the curtain and sort of see how things are done and how things are made. And so I love the idea of doing that with television news. And this seemed to be the perfect story to do that with because there were so many facets of what happened. And then being able to do it with somebody like Cate and see it through her eyes, see it through Marion Mapes' eyes, was really exciting to me.
Truth also stars Stacy Keach as Lieutenant Colonel Bill Burkett, who turned over the Killian documents to CBS. Elizabeth Moss stars as producer Lucy Scott, and Dennis Quaid plays Colonel Roger Charles, who worked with Mary Mapes when she broke the story of prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Topher Grace plays researcher Mike Smith, and John Benjamin Hickey stars as Mark Rolstad, Mapes' husband. Truth was shown at this year's Toronto Film Festival and makes its U.S. debut October 16th. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Thank you, David, and thank you for listening and for listening online as well at voanews.com. That is our program for this day. Visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In theory, every Russian citizen has the right to profess individually or jointly with others any religion or to profess no religion. He or she may also freely choose, possess, and disseminate religious or other beliefs and to act in conformity with them. These rights are guaranteed by the Russian Constitution, which also forbids discrimination or abridgment of the rights of citizens on religious grounds. Yet by law, officials may prohibit the activity of a religious association for violating public order or engaging in extremist activity. Russian law on religion defines Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and Buddhism as the country's four traditional religions, but also grants special status to the Russian Orthodox Church. According to the U.S. State Department's recently issued 2014 Religious Freedom Report, in accordance with the law, government-approved religious groups and other established Judeo-Christian religious groups were mostly left in peace by authorities. That was not the case with minority religious groups, which are required to register with the government, an onerous and expensive process. With the creative use of vaguely worded laws on extremism and incitement to violence, government entities harassed, fined, and prosecuted members of minority religions, even going so far as to confiscate their religious literature. Indeed, laws against extremism have been used to revoke the registration of minority religious groups, to refuse to register certain religious organizations, and to impose restrictions that infringe on the practice of minority religious groups. Such restrictions have hobbled their ability to purchase land and build places of worship. Although Judaism is specifically named as one of Russia's traditional religions, anti-Semitic rhetoric on the part of politicians and government officials, as well as increased anti-Semitic statements in government-controlled media, have risen steadily over the past year. Vandalism of synagogues, cemeteries, and mosques increased. The United States urges the Russian government to afford all citizens the right to worship as they see fit, as stated in the Russian Constitution. The right to religious freedom is not contingent on having a large number of followers, said Secretary of State John Kerry. Religious minorities, including those who profess no faith, should have the same rights as religious majorities, and that is a fundamental belief.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.